Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 153 for comics originally coming out on July 14th, 2010. This is our annual face-to-face episode, so Bob and I are actually in the same room at the same time recording this on a... So if it sounds a little different, that's why. I mean, just the difference of acoustics being live versus doing this over Skype like we normally do.
Well, actually, this week we went with all books that I don't normally get, because that way I just popped down to the shop and bought them instead of waiting for them to come in the mail. So we'd have them here for recording, because we're recording this on Monday, and we would have normally recorded this episode next Saturday, which is still before you're listening to it, but the Saturday before you're listening to this, John and I are both going to be at Comic-Con. So we're starting out in DC with one of the Red Circle titles, sort of integrated into the DCU, though, and it's the Mighty Crusaders, number 1 of 6.
Now, they've dropped the Red Circle logo and name and stuff, which I think was a smart move. I don't think they should have ever mentioned that when soliciting any of the books. And I've been reading all of The Web and The Shield and enjoying them. I thought they were both pretty good. So I'm not surprised sales were as they were, and that those two books ended in... They're doing a 6-issue miniseries to see if this group of characters will survive as a team. But it's one of those that the reason these characters are on the team is because they're all from the same group of characters. There's no logical
particular reason. Yeah.
So it feels a little forced that way. And there were a couple of places where when the team goes into action, it's just, okay, they're in action and we get some generic action shots. There's no sense of either camaraderie, characterization, or even interesting action in those scenes. So aspects of this had a by the numbers of feel to it. The use of the Durlins as the alien race doing a civil war on Earth integrates it into the DC universe, but in a manner that really any alien race could have been used. It's not, relevant that it was the Durlins. And I thought that bringing in a few of the supporting cast characters from the different, from The Web and The Shield made sense. Kit Kat in particular is mentioned briefly there. Overall, I liked it.
Now, I haven't been reading The Web and The Shield. I mean, I think I read the first issue or two and then dropped them, and they made it up to 12?
10.
10? And they're being discontinued at 12?
Ended
at 10, okay.
Yeah, and the final issues have come out.
Okay, so they're done. I only read the very beginning of it. Now, Inferno was a backup in one of them, right?
Inferno was a backup in one of them, and Hangman was a backup in the other, until they swapped out one of them for the Fox.
Because you see the Hangman kind of wandering around in here. Didn't seem to make much sense, other than I guess they just want to keep having all those characters have a presence in this book. Now, Inferno, the thing that seemed kind of weird to me, and maybe you could help me here, is it seems like when he turns on his flame, he's got some big mustache kind of thing going down like a guy in a biker gang would have.
He looks completely different. Powered down versus powered up.
Okay.
They played that up in the backup feature. They played that up in the one shot that led into this.
It's just kind of confusing here because they show him standing here and then he powers up and I was like, wait a minute, is that the same guy? At least they named him.
Yeah.
You know?
But that's the sort of thing where, in terms of accessibility, they could have done a better job in this issue for people who weren't familiar with the character, or specifically this take on the character, to make that part a little clearer. Likewise, they don't really establish the relationship between the Web and Fly Girl here, whereas they did that in the final issue of his book. And again, they do some good stuff here, but a few things could have been a little bit clearer, a little bit better.
Yeah. I mean, other than that, I mean, it seemed to be a perfectly fine story. I wasn't confused at any point. I wasn't you know, I wasn't thinking, wow, I don't know what's going on. I mean, it just, you know, there are a couple of little things like the, you know, Inferno looks different, but I just kind of looked at that and said, oh, well, at least they named him. That's obviously Inferno, so he must look different when he powers up, you know, which is the correct assumption. And, you know, I just kind of went with it. The only thing I would say about this is it was a perfectly fine story and everything, but I would not, I don't really feel compelled to come back again for more of it. I'm not, I don't have any kind of particular attachment to these characters. So it's kind of like, you know, if you like these characters, if you like, you know, this kind of thing, I'd say this is probably a great issue. But if you don't have any particular, you know, desire or history to read these, you can, I'm sure, skip this and it's no skin off your nose. You know, there's no compelling reason in my mind why you would want to track this down and read this issue. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it.
I certainly agree. It's not a must read. I think if you're interested in this group of characters, this is a good book to try out and get a sampling of all of them. It does a good job introducing you to those characters, giving you a sense of them, but not giving you enough to get attached or hooked on any particular one of them, or right. Maybe necessarily the group as a whole, which is a little bit of that by-the-numbers feel I had right. for it. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I thought there was a fair amount of story in here. And you don't have to have read any of the Red Circle stuff that DC's done over the last year to understand this.
It took a decently long amount of time to read. I mean, it seemed like you got your money's worth out of it. And like I said, you can try it, and maybe these characters are really going to click with you, and you're going to say, wow, that's really cool. I want to read more of that. And if so, you can, and otherwise, you know, you don't need to. But again, if you're on a budget, this is probably not a must-spend issue for, you know, $3.99 on picking this one up. But, I mean, the art was serviceable, you know, good standard comic book art, kind of a standard DC house-style looking art, nothing too crazy. Integrating it into the DC universe, I think they feel that they need to do that to keep it going on, but it's just...
Well, they've integrated it from day one.
Right, so. But, I mean, it's not... It sort of feels... I think we talked about this when we talked about it before. I mean, it's tangentially integrated in. It's not like... It doesn't feel like it's... To me, it doesn't feel like a solid part of the DCU.
Well, it's the characters, something they clearly... It feels inserted into the DC universe.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. It's because, not integrated, it's inserted.
Yeah, because it's clear these characters don't have a long history with the DC universe. I mean, we've got Lois and Clark at a press conference here. Oh, it's connected and stuff like that. They've had JSA, Magog, and other characters in the book, Barbara Gordon, etc.
Yeah, and so now that you mention that, it did not even occur to me that that was Lois and Clark.
So, I mean, they've done a good job tightly tying it into the DC universe.
Well, I don't think that is Clark, as a matter of fact, because the guy calls him by name, and he calls him by a different name.
Does it?
He calls him James Tudor. He says, let's get started. Let's start with James Tudor. It's a guy with glasses. Now...
It sure looks like Clark.
What they could have done is they could have said, let's start with Clark Kent. And then,
well,
you know...
It's funny, because on that page... It was actually one of the names that kind of threw me, and it wasn't that name. It was President Suarez.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't realized he won the last election in D.C. You know, I don't really pay attention to who's president of the U.S.
Unless it's Luthor.
Unless it's Luthor, or specifically not Luthor, but yeah. So, no, I saw that and immediately clicked Lois and Clark and didn't even
And I was just kind of reading it, and they used a different name, but... Now that you mention that, that might have been a little more inclusive way if they would have said, now let's start with Clark Kent and then have Lois Lane asking a question, you know, have, you know, some things that tie it in a little more. And, you know,
but they
just
did quite a bit of that in the Web and the Shield. Okay. So I feel that they've integrated well with that. But it's one of those that because these are essentially foreign characters, even as a retooling of them, they're going to have a different flavor, a different feel.
Right.
Just like if you were to take the Fantastic Four and cram them into the DC Universe, there's a fundamentally different aspect to them. You know. So I thought it was good. For me, it was a 4 out of 5. It was a strong book. I think it's a good introduction if you're curious about the Red Circle group of characters. Again, I enjoyed it. I liked it. And, you know, again, I would recommend it, but it's certainly not something I think everybody has just got to go hunt down and go read.
Yeah, and I gave it a 3. There was nothing wrong with it. It just it didn't grab me and cause me to want to read more.
And I can totally see that, because there was that by-the-numbers feel to it in places. So, yeah. Cool.
Okay, and our next book is a one-shot. It's The Uncanny X-Men, The Heroic Age, number one. Well, one-shot, so number one by definition. And this book is kind of a interim kind of book in between some X-Men storylines, it seems like, since I'm not reading most of the X-books, except for X-Factor. And I am going to be trying out that new X-Men book with the vampire stuff in it. But I have not been reading X-Men for a while. I kind of dip my toe in every now and again and stick around for a while and then kind of drift off. This one, written by Matt Fraction's got three stories, Cyclops, Beast, and Hope. Hope is the young girl who was born in that Alaska town that got destroyed, and she's like the last mutant born and all this kind of stuff. And the interesting part about this, and we're going to have a couple of minor spoilers, I think, in this episode.
Well, I think it's unavoidable because this takes place after Second Coming number 2, which came out this week also, but neither of since Bob didn't pick it up since he's not getting all the X books, neither of us have read. But there are certain things that clearly take place after the events in there that are going to almost have to get discussed, maybe.
Yeah. And what's interesting, though, is, okay, so it's three stories. And what I actually liked about this one is a lot of times you get this kind of a book, and it's three stories, and you got, you know, eight-page story, eight-page story, eight-page story. And here, they kind of cut between the three stories.
I almost would have preferred if it had been 8, 8, and 8 versus the intertwining.
Okay, I kind of liked the intertwining because you got a little bit of each. Now, what the only part about the intertwining that didn't work for me is on the Beast story, it's the guys, I think, Steve Sanders and Jaime Mendoza, who did that Sword miniseries, where they have that kind of like horse head Beast, the best I can describe it, where he's got that really, really long, elongated snout, and he doesn't look anything like any Beast you've seen anywhere else. And I didn't have a problem with that. Well, I mean, I had a problem with it, but I mean, when it was just isolated in the Sword and that 5-issue miniseries, like, okay, that's that. And I didn't read the Sword except for the first issue, so it's like, okay. But here, where they have him in the same issue, and it's actually intertwined, and you see the Beast looking like the Beast has looked for several years, this kind of leonine look, and he's in the Cyclops story talking to Scott, and then a couple of pages later, you cut to the Beast story that's set in Los Angeles, and there he is with the goofy, you know, horse head look to him. And they kind of keep cutting back and forth to that.
And that's part of why the cutting back and forth didn't work for me. Add to that at the beginning of the thing where they list the three stories as three separate stories. Yeah. I was expecting different things. So after the first cut from the Cyclops Beast to that Beast and Princess Power or whatever from Runaways, I wasn't expecting them to go back until obviously it happened and stuff. But that intercutting of the art styles, particularly with that one story with the Beast and Power Princess, was a little awkward in places.
Yeah, I like the narrative because Matt Fraction wrote the whole thing. So it's kind of like he wrote the whole thing as a single story, but he just has and he just has the different artists kind of coming in and doing the different pieces, the different scenes. So we have Scott Summers. He starts out in, it seems like, you know, that island, Utopia Island, and then he's down in the Savage Land, I guess shooting dinosaurs with his eye beams for fun. And
Most part, when they cut between the story arcs and the different art teams and stuff, it was at very smooth places in the story, and it was clear it was all written by one guy and meant to be intercut this way. So, you know, that happened a lot smoother. Typically, this sort of a thing, like you said, would be the 3 8-page stories, boom, 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 and fairly disconnected from each other. And even this would have felt much more disconnected to each other if they hadn't been cutting back and forth, whereas what they did and when they did those cuts made them intertwine well and made them good counterpoints to each other. And I don't know that that would have played as well if they had been segmented as the different stories.
Yeah. Now, my favorite part of it was the Hope story. You know, both the dialogue and narrative and the Jamie McKelvey art.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked how we, you know, got some insight into Hope. I like Mr. Fantastic. I like Franklin is in there. But this also comes to the point where it's like, the part that I liked about this is probably the part that X-Men fans would hate. Because it's like mostly dialogue and there's not lots of, you know, Wolverine cutting things in half with his claws.
There's
and
often quite a bit of dialogue in the X-Men stuff, too. I mean, go back to classic era with Claremont, and there was almost nothing but dialogue in places. So
yeah, well, I'm not talking about classic era, because I used to read it back then.
I'm just saying, I do read it now, and there's a lot of that sort of verbosity at times, and I don't think that would turn off your average X-reader just by nature.
Are they in a lab? Are they, like, running
often,
around?
Often. They've got this whole X science team club that the Beast is part of, and the guy with the white hat here, whose name I forget.
I stand corrected.
I mean, there's a lot of navel-gazing type stuff in the X-books at times. And there's also a lot of, you know, Wolverine hacking stuff up. It just depends if you're reading, you know, X-Force or one of the other X-books. I thought it was a good use of Steve Rogers in here, and, you know, him being part of the Cyclops story. I liked him having Hawkeye's bow. That was just kind of a nice touch. And it shows Fraction's understanding of the characters and just putting some, I don't want to say Easter eggs in there, but, you know, things that are not uber essential to the story, but are nice touches.
So now, spoilers. So skip ahead a few minutes if you don't want something spoiled. So apparently Cable got killed in
Second Coming.
And so Hope is all disturbed by this, because obviously Cable... I mean, I know enough about it that he's been essentially
her surrogate father, raising her,
you know, so that bothers her. And that's understandable. But just the way that comics are, especially Marvel and DC comics, I have been trained to not care when somebody dies in a story because they come back every single time.
And I'd have to check, but I think Cable's come back from the dead at least once, if not twice.
And, you know, it's like, well, you know, it's just like when Siren was all upset when Banshee got killed. I mean, they kept Banshee killed. He's still dead. He's been dead for several years. But he's more of a minor character that not too many people give a darn about, so...
He falls into that realm of sacrificable X-Men.
Yeah.
There are other ones that they may get... rid of in some way, shape, or form for a while, but you know, I mean, Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
I can't imagine he's not going to come back at some point. He's too good of a character.
Kitty Pryde, shot off into space. Ooh, forever. Well, until they bring her back. And, you know, it's just like, even Banshee is going to come back at some point. I would bet anything that at some point he will come back.
The next time they try to do a revival of Gen X.
Yeah.
You know.
But, you know, here it's like, okay, Cable's dead. I mean, Cable is a major enough character. There is no way Cable is not coming back.
There is one possible reason they could keep him dead. Because I believe every time he has an appearance or whatever, Liefeld gets some sort of, you know, credit, residual, royalty, whatever. And maybe they're just getting too cheap to pay that. I mean, I'm saying there could be a business reason, but I agree. The likelihood of him staying dead for any... noticeable length of time is zero.
And then moving on from that, we've got this whole extinction thread that goes through the X-Men where no new mutants are supposed to be getting born. You know, Homo Superior is going to go extinct. And, you know, at one point, you know, it seemed like every other person in the Marvel Universe was a mutant.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, then there were just... thousands and thousands, and then they, what was it, the 182, after...
198.
198, I was close, off by about 10%.
Which, for an extinctionable race or whatever, yeah.
But anyway, I mean, you know, so they got rid of mutants, allegedly. That was after Wanda said no more mutants, but, you know,
so
maybe she's not all powerful, because there were still 198 of them, the... ones that people knew. You know,
well, and it's funny, because I could have seen if it was the ones she knew and liked.
Yeah.
And that actually would have been a very interesting dividing line, but you had a couple of people who it's like, who the hell heard of them and who cares?
Yeah.
But imagine, she doesn't like Wolverine, he's no longer a mutant, but still has some of his claws or whatever.
Yeah.
That would have been a very, ooh, she didn't like you, did she?
Yeah.
Twist, but they didn't go that way.
But anyway, so you have this no more mutants. No more mutants are being born. And then Hope, she was born, and she was like the first mutant that was born after that, right?
I believe so, yes.
And then something happened. The whole town got wiped out, and that like kind of brought us into...
That was one of those story arcs. Yeah. That they wiped out the town of Alaska. That's when they killed off Professor X. Of course, he's back. Again, going to your point of how dead is Cable.
Yeah.
You know, and that was 2 years ago.
So no more mutants are being born except Hope was born. Then that other team's trying to kill her, so they hide her in the future, or else at least only, Cable...
Only Bishop was trying to kill her, so Cable jumps through time. They finally figure out where they are, and they send X-Force to...
Okay, so I haven't read any of this, so I don't know this part, but anyway, I just know that, okay, without the exact details, right, she gets brought into the future to save her, Cable raises her, all kinds of crazy adventures going on.
See the Cable series.
You know, whatever happens, see the Cable series. I read the first couple issues of that, got the flavor, you know. But, okay, so now she's back. Long-winded way. But she's back now, and apparently since she's been back, there have been 5 or 6 new mutant births.
That's what I get out of this. I don't recall that having been covered
but,
anywhere
so they
else.
Say that in here. So, you know, she's Hope, and maybe her presence is going to, you know, do this. But... You have this whole extinction thing, and Beast and Molly are talking about extinction, and oh, I don't want mutants to go extinct. And
I like that story.
Well, fine, but again, this whole mutant extinction thing hits me the same way Cable getting killed in.
Oh, yeah.
As a really obvious story device, because you know mutants aren't going extinct in the Marvel Universe. They're not going to be extinct. They're not extinct now. Okay, there was a year or so or two that there weren't any mutant births. They're already setting it up that mutant births are starting again. So they'll be back to full force before you know it. So again, it's just, I find myself not caring about this plot point because they have trained me to not care by any time they do a significant change, they reverse it.
Well, it's much ado about nothing in so much as they can make as big a deal as they want to. Ooh, we're going extinct and stuff, and we're not going to buy into that because we know unless the X-Men sales across the board of the 15,000 titles they're publishing suddenly completely tank, which isn't happening, you know, they're going to keep having mutants.
Right.
They're going to keep having new mutants we've never seen before, even if they've got to fudge how many were in that 198.
Right, right.
So there's a credibility factor there. Both in terms of the death, the whole extinction thing, that is hard to buy into because both in terms of past continuity and future continuity, it's hard to buy into, again, Cable's death because we know that they've got probably no grand plan. Even if they do, the writers and editors are going to change. That plan, by definition, will change. Cable will be back because somebody said, ooh, he's the coolest character. I want to write him. Bam, he's back. That's, you know.
And look at all these guns and pockets and...
Exactly.
Pockets full of guns.
Ooh, he's so cool. I love the 90s. And somebody will bring him back. So because they've shot that level of credibility, and it's not just Marvel. DC's done it. A lot of publishers have done it, mainly the bigger publishers.
Yes.
The smaller ones, there is that anything can happen aspect. But frankly, I think that's a mistake Kirkman's making over an Invincible, where it used to be, ooh, they could do anything. I mean, they had a point recently where they could have, frankly, killed off Invincible, replaced him with another character as Invincible, and gone in a completely new direction, and that would have been, oh, wow, but they didn't. And because they don't have that anything-can-happen aspect, as readers, we have so been trained, okay, mutants will be back eventually. This too-shall-pass mentality is so commonplace, and there is a skepticism, a cynicism, and a blasé nature to the fan base. And as a reader, I certainly have that at times.
Yeah.
That I personally, I think that is a large factor of why sales just continue to have that standard attrition and keep dropping over time.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's really the trouble with this. And it's like, again, I was reading this and I really liked Matt Fraction's writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was some nice dialogue moments in this issue. you know, as someone who I don't read the X-Men books as a rule, except for X-Force, so I'm not reading about any of these characters. I mean, I'm tangentially aware of kind of what's going on in the universe, you know, just from osmosis, I guess, and various things. So, I mean, just you heard, I mean, I kind of, I knew the broad strokes of what was going on,
right?
I
wasn't half of that through preview. So, yeah.
So, you know, as that, I thought it was a fine issue. Again, it's not something that would compel me to jump back in and start reading all of them. That said, though, I'm interested in the Hope thing. So if there's a particularly cool story with Hope doing something, let me know. Or realistically, if Jamie McKelvey started doing the regular art on some book, I would buy it.
McKelvey's
because of his art. You know, I love his art. I love when he did Phonogram and Suburban Glamour. Over at Image, and
great,
you know,
artist.
Love his art, love the face, you know, the facial expressions. I just like his art strikes me in just a very positive way. And if he was doing an X book, I would buy the X book just for his art.
I can totally understand that. I completely agree. As a one shot, I thought this was good. Going back to the "This Too Shall Pass" aspect, out of the three storylines, we've got the riff on the extinction going on, that we know that's going to pass. We had the mutants basically going front and center and quote-unquote going public and getting recognition for that. So that kind of goes against the mutant, anti-mutant hysteria and bigotry stuff, which that too shall pass eventually.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's just going with the heroic age thing. They kind of want to take some of the darker elements out of the Marvel Universe for a while. So they're trying to make it so, you know, from what I gather from this, they saved San Francisco in a very public way, and Cyclops is being recognized by the president, and, you know, all kinds of good things are happening, and, you know, it's going to be bright and sunny until they decide they need to darken it up again.
But it just goes to me to having both aspects of the "this too is passing" and "this too shall pass" future path, you know, aspect to it, which is kind of, I find, humorous.
One thing I do get out of this is Matt Fraction really thinks Cyclops is a total He writes him as a total tool, doesn't he?
Not a total, you know, he's harsh, he's very militaristic, certainly not the kind of leader I would want these days. And it's funny because Scott Summers used to be the kind of leader you would want on the team.
Yeah.
And now...
Well, not even just there, but just his personal actions at the end when he's talking to Hope.
Yeah.
I mean, what a jerk.
He's very much gotten cold and cynical.
He's an unpleasant person, in my opinion.
It's just funny, like, because that too shall pass.
Yeah.
Because sooner or later, Phoenix will come back. Phoenix will bump Emma Frost out of his bed, essentially, or literally, and take that, and I think she's been a negative influence on the character.
Yeah. I mean, I used to kind of like Cyclops, and lately it's just, he's a total jerk. I just dislike the character. You know, it's like...
Well, he's very much a, I need you to do this, so go do that, and not the least bit perfect. He's a bad manager.
But not even, I mean, again, it doesn't, not even his leadership, but just his personal actions is just bad.
Yeah. I don't know. It's one of those that he's gone, as a character, he's gone through so much of a ringer, left, right, and center. Just lost his son, so there's a certain cold detachment to the character that when it goes too far, and I think it is going too far, makes him unlikely.
And whether it makes sense or not, you know, for the story, and it could very well make sense for the story, bottom line is, I dislike the character.
And therefore, I am, you don't want to read the character.
Exactly. And therefore, I am disinclined to read any stories that feature Cyclops in a major role because I dislike the character.
Understandable.
Whereas, I like Mr. Fantastic, you know, so I am inclined to read stories with Mr. Fantastic, you know. I like Steve Rogers. I am inclined to read stories with Steve Rogers, you know.
Well, and there's
for characters. A while, Tony Stark was acting like a total jerk.
Yes.
And I was disinclined to read stories with Tony Stark. He's back now that he's rebooted his head to not being a total jerk anymore. And, you know,
but that kind of story that'll
pass.
Goes,
yeah,
I know. But that's the reset button gets used too many times for us to buy into stuff.
But I just think that a hero should not be like that. I mean, you go back, and
well, particularly at the beginning of the heroic age.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, they're heroes for a reason. They're supposed to be role models. They're supposed to be good. Make a bad guy, or make something that is explicitly an anti-hero book. It's like, I don't care if Cable acts, imagine, you know, a certain way.
If they had taken this storyline for Cyclops in this issue, and the approach had been, we've just gone through a rough patch, a war, literally, that we were at risk of extinction. Tough decisions had to be made. He regrets some of them, but now he's trying to get back into the, let's do the right thing, let's go for the bright and sunny, you know,
yeah,
and get back on that path. And they didn't go that way.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's, again, you know, I'm going to put another spoiler in here. That is, okay, he is given the Presidential Medal of Freedom, you know, for his role in saving San Francisco, the highest civilian honor that you can get. They could have gone along the path of, that helps him be, you know, oh, I'm proud, now. I'm accepted, I am. And at the end of the story, he takes it and he throws it in the ocean. Jerk. Jerk move. I could be totally off base on this, because maybe there are tons of fans out there who loved that. You know, oh, he threw the man's thing into the ocean, and, you know, it's, whatever. But it's like,
at some point,
I dislike that.
They could,
it ruined that story for me.
No, and I get that, but I could easily see them doing a follow-up with Namor having fished it out and basically doing a, this is when I got this award, and I'm this, you know, arrogant, you know, ruler of Atlantis, and this is why I valued it.
Yeah.
And kind of a something where they could do a good story between the two. Agreed. They haven't done that yet. We'll see if they ever do. Personally, yeah. I gave that issue a 4 out of 5. I thought it was good art, with the exception of that Beast story. But even that had really good character moments. And it was one that it was a quieter issue of an X-Men book where we got to know the characters. They did some plot points, whatever. And, you know, I enjoyed it. But I'm also reading all the X books. You know, I'm a little behind a week or two, but... So I had a better context for that.
Yeah, and I'm going to go, you know, with the same 3 that the Crusaders got, in that it really, I mean, it was an okay, I liked the story. Matt Fraction had some really nice dialogue moments and everything, but Matt Fraction also, you know, had Scott throw the medal in the water, Matt Fraction also,
a certain, you know, segment, yeah.
Also had, you know, a hand in the shaping of the X, you know, I mean, he's a key writer of X. So this whole, you know, extinction that I don't care about, and Cable being dead that I don't care about because it's not going to happen. You know, I kind of lay that. It's not all on Matt Fraction, but just, you know, Marvel in general, just the way that they do things. So,
but,
you know,
going back to the middle of you know, freedom getting thrown in the ocean, that is something that they're going to have fallout from, because there's going to be a certain contingent of the fan base that's just, you do not do that. That's disrespectful, kind of a thing. We'll see how big of an outcry there is on that, but I can definitely see there being.
I would say there's also probably a segment of the fan base who would applaud that.
I don't know.
You know, it's just, you know, what's your viewpoint on such things? Anyway, moving into the last one, we have Dynamite. We have Widow Warriors. And this is Dynamite in cooperation with 852 Films. What I was going to do, and I forgot to do it, is look this up and see if there's some actual movie in development about this, or what the deal is with this. So hopefully we won't get lambasted too much on being unaware of the deep history of this story or these characters.
My knowledge of this property prior to reading it was the title. So I come in completely cold and unaware and will completely fess up to that. Overall, I liked the story. It's not the kind of thing I would normally gravitate to and go put on my pull list. The art was good. The coloring really dragged this book down for me.
Very dark.
Very dark. Very hard to pull stuff out of the panels. And that really hampered the story from me. You know, it was a barrier to entry to the book, and I was very disappointed by that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, the premise of this, it's set in China in the past. I don't know if they set the exact, I guess they say that's a long range though, right? From 986 to 1068 AD, the Northern Song Dynasty was under constant threat of invasion along the western border. So I'm assuming it's somewhere in that range. So let's say it's around the year 1000-ish, in the middle of that range. So yeah. at some point, this one clan goes off and they get thoroughly stomped in battle by the, you know, opposing bad, evil forces who
are clearly, you know, superior.
Who are, you know,
number and weaponry.
They just did a number on all the men in this clan, pretty much killed them except for like the one guy who comes back and says, everyone's been killed.
Well, in that respect, it's like the Battle of 300, except when, you know, that movie ends or that story ends and you've got the runner going back to tell the other people or whatever. Here, the runner goes back to tell the wives, the spouses, the daughters, the mothers, whatever, you know, and then they take action. So it's the kind of a storyline, that aspect we've seen before, but it was a good, you know, different part of it with the repercussions of that moving forward. And, you know, they did a good job setting the scene of the battle, getting us to know just enough about the characters to know, oh, this is a side we should care about, and they're getting stomped. And then getting to know, you know, their spouses and families and stuff like that. Then they get the message, and then things progress. So, I mean, they did a good job getting us attached enough to the right characters at the right times.
The thread that's running through my mind as I read this book is, okay, all the men have been killed. And both in knowing how women were treated back then, as well as the way that these women actually are treated in the course of this story of, oh, you're just women, we don't need to respect your opinion, which was a prevalent opinion, frankly, you know, 1,000 years ago. You know, it was unfortunately an opinion 100 years ago and yeah. 50 years ago and stuff. You know, it's not nothing new. It's very different than the way we, hopefully everyone, treats women today as, you know, equal. But the problem I have is back in China back then, these women would not have had any reason to have ever touched a weapon before in their life.
Whereas they did seem to have some sort of training,
you know,
and ability to...
And they, what they probably should have done, if they're going to set up a story where the whole premise of it is that these women are jumping on horses, picking up weapons, and riding off, and they're going to get revenge for their husbands on the force that actually killed their husbands, which would kind of have to mean that
they're better
fighters than their husbands were.
Yes.
You know... It would have seemed like you should have some kind of a setup here where this particular clan is different from all the other clans in that their women are trained in secret and know all these secret ways of fighting and stuff.
To establish the fighting prowess.
Exactly. That's the part that I lost my suspension of disbelief about halfway through this. I mean, I knew it was coming, too, because of the title of the book,
yeah.
Widow Warriors. I knew that was, you know, okay, the men are getting killed. It's called Widow Warriors. Therefore, the women are going to come.
And the widows will be warriors. Yeah. I think that's obvious.
Yeah. You know, it's just, I think it would have been a better story had they done something to establish that this particular clan's women were actually qualified warriors, and they had to do that in secret because it's so different from the prevalent feeling of the day and, you know, whatever.
But setting up how they were the warriors that they are was where it failed, because they did set up that they had the fighting prowess when they got to the gate, and to get let out, one of the ladies had to go basically beat this general.
Right.
And she did. But then the question is, if she's so good, why wasn't her husband and so forth? Why weren't they as good?
Right. And maybe that's going to be in a subsequent issue. They'll have some flashback where they set that up. I think...
That should have been in the first
issue. It should have been in the first issue of a book like this. They should have made that, spent a few pages establishing that. Other than that, I mean, it was a decent enough story. But, I mean, like John said, I do think that the dark, murky coloring really dragged this down, that and, you know, stylistically the story. Other than that, if you're, you know, big on, you know, kind of the sword, you know, sword fighting and, you know, ancient battle kind of thing, revenge type of story, this will be up your alley. It was certainly entertaining enough as long as you can kind of get beyond some of that. I mean, it was a well-told story, I thought, and the art, again, where it was not totally obscured by the coloring was good. But, I mean, I got to ding it on that coloring because it seems to me that the colors are by pencils and cover by Pat Lee, and the colors are by Michelle Lowe and Pat Lee. So the guy's coloring his own art, and he's doing a bad job of it, you know. And this is, you know, we've talked about this in other places. I don't know what editors do anymore, at least as far as the art goes. Because you go back to this X-Men book, and some editor somewhere should have not been accepting art that has the Beast look completely different in two stories in the same issue.
That, I completely agree with that. That shouldn't have happened, shouldn't have been allowed to happen, and they should have known basically by choosing that artist that was going to happen.
Right.
With the coloring, there is the possibility that when you look at it on the screen with the computer monitor and it being lit up and stuff,
yeah, maybe
it didn't seem as murky. But that still means they didn't check the proofs and didn't adjust the brightness or whatever.
Well, you know, that's so the kind of thing where if that's the case, then they really should be printing out pages and looking at them.
And CrossGen was smart enough when they were in business to actually have the same kind of a printer that was getting used to print their books in-house to where they could print the thing out and look over what it was going
to
look like.
But again, I mean, to me, that should be a basic job of an editor of a book, is proofing what the finished product is going to look like and saying, this looks murky, and having the, you know, just the wherewithal to go to the artist and say, look, I know you're the artist, but...
But even the colorist, you know, part of that job should be understanding how the colors you're putting on the computer screen are going to look on the printed page, since that's the final output.
Yeah.
So I agree with you on both counts, both here and how the Beast was looking, that the editors are not stepping up to the plate, doing what they should be doing. In both cases, the art team in Widow Warriors, the colorist in the Heroic Age, the penciler, are not doing their job either. Widow Warriors, for me, 3 out of 5.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, same thing. Kind of like a 3 out of 5. It was not great. Well, I mean, it was a good enough story. I mean, it was not... Nothing kicked it up above the bar. It was kind of like, you know, right there, 3 out of 5. It was right in the middle of the road for me.
I liked it, but not enough to say, ooh, I've got to get the next issue.
Right.
But not, I didn't dislike it and say, ooh, I'm not going to get the next issue either. You know, it's one of those that I came in kind of, yeah, it's an average comic, it's good, left feeling more or less the same way.
Yeah.
But if I hadn't liked this story as much as I did, the coloring would have been enough to knock it down easily to a 2 for me.
Right.
And say, I'm not getting this.
Right.
So... It's the kind of thing that if they were to make into a movie, I would certainly want to check out the trailer, because it seemed like the kind of thing that could be a good kind of Hong Kong action kind of a thing, kind of a film, and have some good fight scenes, some good spectacles.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, I look at, and it's like, it would be a better movie than a comic in many cases, I think. This is the kind of thing that would kind of has that cinematic quality, and if you saw this, you know, just kind of in action...
Yeah, I agree. I think it worked better as a film than it did as the comic. Obviously, we haven't gotten our shipments. We haven't read anything else this week. I am behind on previous weeks. I think I've got about 112 comics stacked up from previous weeks that I need to be catching up on at some point, plus whatever's in this shipment, plus whatever's in the next shipment by the time I get home. So I'm going to have just all kinds of stuff piled up.
How many comics fit in the short box?
At least 112, but not much more. So
I've got about 450 behind.
Yeah. So anything else for this?
Or? No, I think that's good.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Amazing Spider-Man number 638 from Marvel, Time Masters Vanishing Point number 1 from DC, and Walking Dead number 75 from Image.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.